Jane, you're a journalist originally from Armagh, and
That's right.
you're currently living in Beirut and working around that region and doing stuff for PBS, amongst other people. The journey from Armagh to Beirut, how on earth did you get into journalism and end up going so far?
It's something I know it's very fashionable for a lot of people in the industry to say, oh, I just kind of fell into journalism. It chose me, etc. But I have to be honest, I've wanted to be a television reporter, a broadcast journalist for probably my whole adult life, at least. I mean, ever since I was a kid, really. So I went to Armagh Royal School, and then I went to university in England, in York, and it was really from there. I mean, I got out of university in 2007, and literally no one was hiring. I mean, it was whether you wanted to, no matter how open-minded you were about whether or not you wanted to work at a newspaper or in broadcasting. I mean, beggars couldn't be choosers. Anybody who could get a paying job in journalism would take it. But back then, the industry was just in tatters. And so I went abroad, actually. I flew to Yemen and studied Arabic for a few months until I ran out of money. And then I took a job at a newspaper in Dubai. Because essentially, if you looked abroad, there were some jobs, and that kind of led to one thing to another, and then I ended up freelancing for CNN, who had opened a big office in the UAE where I was living, and from there I went on to working for Al Jazeera English, and then from there on to working for other outlets like PBS.
And you never managed to come back. The lure of three types of spuds and no vegetables didn't lure you back to the orchard county.
When I get back to Icons Festival, it's going to be a strange year for me. It will be my third time in Northern Ireland this year. So lately, I've been doing a lot better than before. I've pitched Irish stories again and again at both Al Jazeera and PBS. But news organizations are very much so, their own creatures in that they have European people covering Europe stories, and I'm very much so seen as the Middle East girl at the minute. So it's a bit difficult for me to sell stories in Ireland at the minute, but I always do. I try to keep pitches in there from Ireland if I can.
You've been at this now for 7 or 8 years. I mean, even in that time, foreign reporting, if that's what how we describe what you do, I mean, that has changed quite a lot.
Yeah, enormously. I mean, on every level, really, everything has changed from, broadcast organizations. Everything, of course, budgets are tighter than they have been for a long time. The region is more dangerous than it probably ever has. And all of these, and then of course, technology has changed. And all of that has gone into basically, people typically say, oh, the industry's in crisis, or, there's no money in newspapers and broadcasting is struggling. But in reality, it's just all in a massive flux on various levels. It's a multi-layered changes, editorially, practically, and technologically. So I think that's something that is continuing and will continue for years.
I mean, there's a lot more freelancing going on within foreign reporting, isn't there? And a lot less kind of like organizational structure that is kind of there to fall back on.
Absolutely. And the freelancing is, I mean, there have always been freelancers, but now I feel as though it's really increasing in foreign coverage because news organizations of the past would have had bureaus in almost every capital city you can think of. They would have had, our man in Moscow or our man in Cuba or someone in every Middle Eastern capital. And it's just not practical anymore. They simply don't have the budgets. So freelancers that are already in the field are becoming even more of an integral part of coverage. And that goes for everything from camera operators to producers to correspondents.
And you also have fewer people hanging around. I mean, you're much more multi-skilled. You're not going to have a whole team of three or four traveling around.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, and that goes for everybody in the industry. Cameramen who can't edit will struggle now to get work because, you won't hire editors and cameramen. You'll increasingly in foreign coverage, it'll be both. And now I actually work with a producer who's also the cameraman and the editor. Very often the two of us go in as a two-person team. When I first started out, because of my own budgetary constraints, when I first started doing television work and working with CNN, I would film myself, which in challenging places like Somalia and Yemen would be extremely difficult, but it's simply a budgetary reality. But it's becoming so much easier now with people using DSLR cameras. Those have really made it a lot easier for self-shooting, and all the gadgets that go with them have made that easier. So it's technology, but it's also budgets.
This conversation will end up published on Sluggo Tool, which is a blog. Citizen journalism, certainly around the bits of the world where you're working, has been quite crucial to getting some of the stories out where, if you like, mainstream reporters can't actually get in, or it's not very safe, or can't be everywhere at once to kind of cover some of the kind of social changes and political changes that are going on. What's your sense, or what's your feeling about the kind of level of citizen journalism and what it brings?
The phrase citizen journalism is such a broad idea, mm-hmm. you know. In fact, nobody, I don't even, to my knowledge, has really defined what it is. One thing that we have always had, it's worth pointing out, and that news organizations have always had, is local stringers on the ground. And that will be your Iraqi reporters, your Afghan reporters, your Yemeni reporters, who are providing information and news lines and confirmation. Mm-hmm. Local cameramen who are providing footage that it's too dangerous for foreign cameramen to get. Increasingly that's happening, but without the correspondent being in Baghdad or the correspondent being in Damascus. Partly because of security constraints. There's a major challenge there, of course, trying to verify the information that comes out. And I think one danger is when the line between, especially in the post-Arab Spring mm-hmm. world, is the line between activists and journalists gets blurred. So, you know, journalists have to take information from activists and then try to confirm it with their own sources. And there's an incredible amount of journalism being done right now via Skype, mm-hmm. for better or for worse, when it comes to places like Syria, mm-hmm. because it's simply too dangerous to even have a bureau, you know, anywhere inside Syria at the minute that would be a permanent place for reporters to at least feel a little bit closer to the story.
You're based in Beirut. That's your kind of your headquarters. That's where your bedroom is, exactly. to come back to. But I talked to Marina Shama. She's High in the East on Twitter last week. She lives in Beirut as well, and she's been, I guess, kind of witnessing and probably taking part in some of the You Stink protests over the lack of kind of garbage collection and the wider political problems in Lebanon. Even there, it's not quite a revolution, but it's a protest movement that is online, probably periscoping itself as the police and army units and things try and kind of water cannon them off the roads. I mean, it's a strange mix of activism and reporting and just trying to get some news out.
It is. It's you know, it's information sharing in any kind of a way, and in many ways, everybody is linked at protests all over the Middle East. You know, I mean, now the protests in Lebanon aren't necessarily that similar to Arab Spring protests, but protests in general just simply don't take place in this part of the world without a major online presence. It just doesn't happen, to the extent where you'll see, not so much in Lebanon, but in other countries, you'll see the governments will shut down cellular services mm-hmm. if they want to shut down a protest. As shutting down cellular service is sometimes more effective than, you know, basically coming in with tear gas. Mm-hmm. So that is a protest. I mean, what once it's online, there's a feeling of inevitability that it will physically manifest and happen on the streets.
You've been in and out of Syria.
Just the once I was in Homs itself, in the in rebel controlled Homs.
Does it make a real difference when you see it through your eyes and you're kind of not mediating it through other people's pictures or other people's recollections of what was happening?
Absolutely. I mean, there's no true substitute for going somewhere. There never will be, regardless of the technology and the communications. Because when you're there, of course, you're going to be relying on your own smarts and your own, basically your own perceptions as a journalist. You can also, there are countless things you need to do. Like, you need to assess the people you're getting the information from, whether or not they seem to be reliable sources, and what motivates them. You need to, you know, anything from casualty figures, you need to be able to go and look at some pretty uncomfortable sites to mm-hmm. be able to confirm things like that. There really is no there really is no substitute, because at the end of the day, everything that comes through on YouTube, everything that comes through on Skype still is unverified.
Do you fear, though, that it's tricky for you to get back into Homs and back into Syria with any regularity? And there are other places in the world that really journalists either aren't welcome or they're really too remote and too dangerous to get to. I'm thinking maybe like South Sudan, which is somewhere which has been in upheaval nearly yes. since the moment and hour that the country was created. And yet absolutely. It's a place that we get very little reporting from because it's just so difficult to get there.
You're absolutely right. It's getting so much worse, and it's already very, very bad. There are an enormous amount of countries where we have limited access to, and some that we don't have any. I don't know of any journalists regularly now going in and out of rebel-controlled Syria. Mm-hmm. It's simply too dangerous. Even Yemen, you know, is becoming incredibly dangerous. I was in Sana'a in June. But it's an extremely difficult, difficult place to visit now. Places like Libya, places that journalists used to be in and out of all the time. But like as with Sudan, you know, you bring in another important point, which is that governments are making it difficult. It's not just terrorist organizations. It's not just kidnapping threats and the usual physical threat of combat zones. It's governments. It's the Egyptian government arresting, fining, imprisoning journalists, mm-hmm. the Turkish government arresting journalists, accusing them of being terrorists. And in Sudan as well, the Sudanese government, the South Sudanese government, increasingly hostile towards journalists. So for many journalists, it's governments that are as much a hindrance as the physical danger of terrorist organizations.
Does it mean that we, I guess, as a global world, we don't really get a full picture of what's going on? There are places that we like. At the moment, refugees, Syria, Calais, and so on, very much dominating the British and probably the Irish news agenda. But there are other places that just we'll never find out about because nobody can get there or nobody is interested in telling us that story.
I think that's absolutely fair to say. I really think that for a start, the censorship, the increasing censorship and intimidation of journalists by governments in the Middle East and South Asia and beyond, unfortunately, is working. In many places, it is working. There's no picture coming out of the Sinai, for instance, of what's going on there. How do people survive there and what life is like there? It's a complete lockdown on journalists. You know, there's very little coming out of many countries. The Iraqi government, Baghdad, no journalists can't get visas to go to Baghdad anymore. It's very, very, very difficult to get a visa to get into Baghdad. And that, of course, was famously a place where journalists were in and out of for years and years and years. So, you know, this is an increasing problem. Unfortunately, it's working. That's why you're not seeing picture from places like that. That's why you're not seeing reports. Because, you know, essentially, especially for television journalism, it is a visual medium. Mm-hmm. Even if there is a story in the Sinai, it will never get the same amount of coverage as it would if there was picture, or even more so if there was a journalist stood there from the network who could actually report on it on the ground. So unfortunately, that is true. I think that's why people may not necessarily be noticing, but there are black holes in coverage in terms of certain countries in the Middle East and beyond.
Where would you love to be at the moment? Where would be the places that, if you could, you would like to be reporting from or like to be ferreting around trying to expose stories and tell them?
I'd love to do some work in Iran. I've never been to Iran before. It is supposed to be, I mean, the amount of journalists I meet who, as it's like a roll call, everybody says Iran is their favorite country. If you ask them, mm-hmm. where's their favorite place in terms of culture and richness and stories and people and, of course, food. And so it would be a remarkable place to tell stories from. I also think Myanmar at the minute, Burma, is very, very interesting with the lead up to hopefully democratic elections in November. That's something that sort of is on my watch at the minute. It's a little further east than I'm usually reporting from, but that is a place that I would be very much so interested in really getting down sort of the unbeaten path in there and having a look around and telling stories.
You've been at this for less than 10 years. You're relatively young. Is this a career and a lifestyle that you fancy sustaining for the next kind of 30 or 40 years? Will you turn into a John Simpson?
Well, I have yet to find, to be tempted by another profession or career. I really do have days where I cannot believe that I get to do this for a living. I'm incredibly lucky. If you're interested in travel and current affairs and people, and you like to meet people and you love, if you're really, really interested in connecting with people around the world, I don't think there's a better job than this. I'm incredibly lucky. And of course, there are days as well where you're working 20 hours a day and living in very rudimentary conditions where you might think the opposite. But right now, I can't see myself doing anything else.
Do you think your careers teacher in Armagh quite appreciates what you ended up doing?
I don't know, actually.
They haven't invited you back.
Sure. It's funny. I think some, especially like my family at home and some people maybe from where I come from, kind of wish I was on the BBC more, because then they would be seeing me on air a bit more.
You'd exist.
Everybody has to go online instead. So, but everybody seems very, very encouraging.
Okay. And if people want to hear more from you directly, you'll be in Belfast as part of the Icons Festival, which I think is festivaloficons.com, and has a strapline of the icons of where the icons of today inspire the icons of tomorrow. So if you want to find out more about Jane, folk can look up Icons Festival and find out more. You'll be there towards the end of September, and I'll maybe see you there. Thank you very much for your time.
Sir. Thank you.